one of the things at stake in this election is not actually on the ballot. It's what our politics and political institutions look like in the future. For the Republican Party, the midterms are turning into a referendum on Trumpism. For the Democratic Party, the past year and a half have been a period of intense debate about the party's values, about which voters it tries to appeal to and mobilize, where it will and will not take money from, and how its internal governance systems work. The most thorough public intervention on this front was a report put together by a collection of people from the progressive wing of the party. Freshly energized by the insurgent Bernie Sanders campaign in the 2016 primary, it was called Autopsy: The Democratic Party in Crisis. And now, after a year of public battles on primary ballots and policy fights inside the Democratic National Committee, they're out with a one-year update. I'm joined by the editor of that report, Norman Solomon. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
First off, what was your goal with this project in the first place?
From the outset, really, to fill a gap that was left by the failure, really, of the Democratic National Committee to do what traditionally a national party does after a catastrophic election, and that is to put together what is shorthanded as an autopsy. It was really conspicuous because you get into 2017. It was such a horrific result to put Trump in the White House, etc., and yet the Democratic National Committee basically engaged in no autopsy or really public self-examination, self-assessment at all. So at rootsaction.org, we basically commissioned an independent task force to look at what went wrong for 2016, and inevitably that meant going back to backstories for many years. And we issued that report exactly a year ago, and to put it mildly, it was very critical, very tough. It got a pretty resonant response, including the great chronicler of the Democratic Party, William Grider, wrote a front page, really a cover story for The Nation, examining our autopsy in detail. And we got a lot of positive response from the grassroots, as well as back channel some real unhappiness from the new regime of the Democratic National Committee under Chair Tom Perez. So this summer, we realized that it would be appropriate to issue a one-year later update, which is what we've just done. And by the way, it's on the web at democraticautopsy.org. And I'm glad to say that there have been some significant changes in the last 12 months.
What do you think are the most significant?
I would put in the positive category of party democracy, that a lot of the outrage during the 2016 campaign from Bernie Sanders delegates, and I think some disquiet even among Hillary Clinton supporters, was the use of superdelegates to really tilt the scales for the establishment favorite Hillary Clinton. And a good analogy, I think, is if you have a race between two contestants and the starting gun goes off and one contestant is way ahead, that is in the form of establishment superdelegate support. And it's not just, okay, they have, in the case of Hillary Clinton, before a single ballot was cast in a primary caucus, half of all the superdelegates already in her corner, Bernie getting almost none, but also what that brings in terms of the label of front runner and momentum and fundraising and so forth. So that, I think, was a major blight on the party and any sense among not just progressives, but a lot of other folks, a blight on the notion that the Democratic Party functioned well, to use a word, democratically. So the Unity Reform Commission of the Democratic National Committee was put in place, really, I think, to try to smooth over those problems and create a sense of, as the name conveyed, unity. And long story short, we're able to say in this autopsy that there has been real progress because the power of superdelegates, which is members of Congress who are Democrats, other elected officials, some lobbyists, their power essentially to help determine who the nominee for president of the party, that power has been virtually eliminated. There has not been a second ballot in choosing a Democratic Party presidential nominee since 1952. And by eliminating their power to vote on the first ballot, I think it's a message and also a way of saying from the top of the party, we hear you. We're understanding that the cohesion of pro-Hillary forces in November 2016 was really damaged by this undermining of democracy within our own parties. That's a plus. Also, voter participation. We chronicled a year ago that there was scant staffing at the DNC to fight this awful racist, xenophobic voter suppression that Republicans have implemented and executed in so many states. And in the last year, the DNC has upped the staffing. It has given money in more than 40 states to, as much as possible, combat voter suppression. So I think those are some of the most important positive trends in the last year.
And where's it been lagging the most?
I think in two categories that we also chronicle in this latest report, Democratic Autopsy, 1 year later. One is corporate power, that what Bernie Sanders was talking about throughout the campaign, what he called the oligarchy. And, you know, since then, the news media, as before, you would think that the only oligarchs were in Russia. Well, they also exist in the United States with a huge leverage over the political and media electoral system. And in the last year, there's really been no positive movement. As a matter of fact, we talk about in this new report that many Democrats in the House and Senate voted in favor of rolling back key provisions of Dodd-Frank in terms of banking regulation. The DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and the DNC still take large quantities of corporate funds. And it's been notable that the leadership of the Democrats in both houses of Congress, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, have really not been willing to address the power of Wall Street and the big banking industry and so forth over party funding and really policy. So that's been, if anything, worse. I think the Dodd-Frank vote is an indication. The other big area has to do with militarism, war in the Democratic Party. There was a set of news releases put out by Chuck Schumer and by Nancy Pelosi at the time of the recent vote over the Trump budget to increase military spending, which they like to call defense spending, by 11%. And it's just astronomical increases in what's already a bloated and destructive military budget. And both Pelosi and Schumer boasted and bragged in their news releases, "We stand firmly behind President Trump's budget increases for the Pentagon." And it's very difficult to find people in the top layers of Democratic Party leadership on Capitol Hill who challenge the very concept of perpetual war. They're all in. We do have some positive signs. Ro Khanna from South Bay in the House, a fresh person, congressman, has done great work to challenge, for instance, the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and the war on Yemen. There are some bright spots, but when it comes to leadership, the Democratic Party is still very much on the war train.
I wonder how important the leadership is. It seems like one of the trends in this election has been record amounts of grassroots donations coming directly into Democratic coffers. And that diminishes the comparative power of someone like Nancy Pelosi, who one of her functions within the party is to connect the donor class to the elected officials.
Yes. I think that this is a gradual sea change, if you will, that hopefully we're just beginning to see. When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won in the primary, this huge upset against Joe Crowley, the number four Democrat in Queens and Bronx, Pelosi was quick to say it was an anomaly and didn't speak to the underlying dynamics for the Democratic Party in the country. And yet, I think Bernie Sanders showed the tremendous resonance when leaders and potential leaders running for office speak to questions of class, of economic inequality, and the power of Wall Street. And the traditional paradigm is exactly what you described. Progressives who are griping about it don't matter. But Bernie raised, of course, huge amounts of money on an average of $27 per donation and shown that you can blow away the big corporate interests in funding terms by appealing to the base. And I think there's a lot of ambivalence, and we have a section in this autopsy update about social movements in the party. The DNC and the Democratic Party leadership, they need social movements. They need progressives who are spoken for by those social movements to contribute money to the party and to volunteer and to vote, but generally they haven't wanted us to do anything else like push them towards, say, Medicare for All. And I think there's been a recognition that the power of the base has been mobilized to such an extent that, for instance, almost all of the major Democratic presidential contenders who are being touted for 2020 have now called for single-payer Medicare for All, whereas 8 years ago, none of them had done that.
And Barack Obama said it was a good idea in September.
Safely out of office, he says it's a good idea.
Yeah, but still.
It's a barometer, yes. Is it something is changing here, and it's because of the power of people organizing and raising hell, whether it is democratizing the party, where there's been real progress, although not enough in the last year, and also a lot of policy issues such as health care. I imagine the people who are listening, there are a few, maybe more than a few, who are thinking, the hell with the Democrats. Why bother with all this? And other folks listening may think, well, we shouldn't be talking about what's wrong with the Democratic Party. We should just be focusing on Republicans. And I think both of those perspectives, while understandable, are, if I may say so, dead wrong. Because there is no way, unless we're going to get into a fantasy world, which isn't helpful in politics, there's no way to roll back the right-wing Republican power of the executive or legislative branch and increasingly in the judicial branch unless you get them out of office. And the only way you're going to do that from here to the horizon is get Democrats in to defeat them. So that on the very from the jump should be clear that progressives have a huge stake in defeating Republicans. And then the other point of view is, oh, pipe down. Don't criticize Democrats. We're supposed to defeat Republicans. The problem with that is that unless you have stronger Democratic Party campaigns and stronger candidates able to defeat the Republicans, then it's counterproductive to say don't do self-critiques and improve yourself. On the one hand, there's a mythology, and the mass media reinforces constantly, that there's this left-to-right spectrum. It's all locked in. And when the right wing is entrenched, you have to move towards them to get the so-called persuadable, ostensibly moderate Republicans, an endangered species, to put it mildly. And so the much better strategy is one that's not worked out theoretically. It's worked out in the real world when you have someone such as Bernie Sanders leading the way to say there is such a thing as progressive populism. The Democratic Party is going to be a loser as long as it seems to defend an unjust status quo, not inspiring and mobilizing its base to organize and be active and turn out to vote.
I wonder if there isn't a parallel in coming up with a one-size-fits-all prescription. Like the country is not a uniform country. There are different dynamics in different districts. Maybe you need some people like Andrew Gillum running base mobilization campaigns, trying to get people to the polls who've never voted before. But if you want to defeat a Roy Moore in Alabama, the best strategy is to be an inoffensive centrist Democrat and let the guy facing multiple pedophilia accusations run against himself.
Well, there's no doubt that there are regional and local differences, and that's going to affect the terrain. At the same time, the conventional wisdom is, hey, you know, Bernie Sanders should have modulated if he wanted to appeal to those who, as it turned out, in many cases, were Trump voters. And that's where the left-right paradigm, the moderate left-right thing, tends to break down. I think of what happened in 1968 when Robert Kennedy, charismatic but also articulating a populist program, appealed to a lot of voters, including in the South, who then went for George Wallace. And one would think, why would people go from at that point, anti-war left-wing candidate to a racist pro-war guy like George Wallace? And I think that unlike you and me and many people, I would guess, listening, who feed on a lot of analysis and political views, most Americans are not ideological. They're practical. They think about what affects them. And as Jim Hightower, the great Texas populist, has been saying for decades, who won statewide in Texas, not a particularly left-wing state, to put it mildly, he says it's not so much left-right as up-down. And I think, you know, there are a lot of caveats there. There is such thing as a progressive left that we should embrace and fight for, and we should always have eternal hostility to racism, sexism, xenophobia, and other bigotries. But I think that there is something huge in potential for people speaking out and saying, I represent fighting the power structure, and that doesn't need to be parsed in left-right terms. But we had Paul Wellstone, for instance, because he seemed real, because he was real, he could bring in voters who, if you would go to the local voting records, would never vote for him. And I think that's our hope for the future.
Yeah. I want to hone in on that difference between seeming real and being real, because it strikes me that we are in an era where you can, by virtue of cold political calculation, decide you're not going to take corporate contributions and that you're going to be for single-payer Medicare for all, because those are popular positions. They will help you raise more on crowdfunding platform than you would get through other channels. But that does not necessarily equate to action in office. We learned in California, it's very easy for Democrats to posture on single payer when they have the safety of a Republican governor who will veto it. It's a very different thing entirely when Jerry Brown's in the governor's office and they don't want to put him in a difficult position. I can't help but wonder if the people who've joined the newly formed Medicare for All caucus in the House aren't of a similar stripe. They're signing up to a political brand, but not a political agenda or an accountability relationship with the people who believe in that issue.
No doubt in some, perhaps many cases, that is true. And I think an underlying context, which is ongoing, which is that, to be rather blunt about it, the upside of opportunistic politicians is that if you change what is opportunistic through the force of social movements, then you've got them. And if you can sustain those movements and transform public opinion in the country and mobilize it, then you have a real possibility to get allies functionally, if not emotionally and psychologically, at the top. And I think that is part of the refutation of those who say, well, you know, I'm not going to support any Democrats because of the party's so bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is that if we have Republicans in power, especially of the current type of Republican, but generally this has been true, no matter how powerful your social movements are, you're going to get a Gorsuch. You're going to get a Kavanaugh nominated by these right-wing racists in the Oval Office and who are around the Republican president. You can push on that wall all you want, but your capacity to change policy, whether it's for social justice in many dimensions or single payer and on, you're still up against state power, which is held by an immovable wall called the right wing. Whereas you get in an Obama, you get in someone who is more malleable, even worst depiction of him, an opportunist, still there's a base there that if it can be mobilized effectively can change the direction of the country. And I think that's where we are. So to be specific, I mean, a year and a half ago, Kamala Harris, the junior senator from California, was traveling around the country, meeting with the big donors, Bill Clinton, 1990s style, lining up for president as basically a new version of a new Democrat. And the organizing and the momentum and the hell-raising around this country behind, for instance, single payer has had an aggregate effect. And as progressives have shown their muscle and ability to inject themselves into the electoral arena, she has signed on to single payer and she's sworn off corporate PAC money. And frankly, does that mean I trust her? No, it's not a matter of trust. It's a matter of creating the kind of pressure and political environment to hold feet to the fire and have some leverage over people in office.
So I guess that's the question I want to land on. What does it look like to organize not just for winning elections, but for accountability after Election Day?
I think every 2 years it should be 24 months every day. And part of the problem is, I think what we're sort of referring to is putting people in office and then, oh, we did our job. You know, we elected Barack Obama. He's sworn in January 2009. It was a huge mistake. Groups backing off, trusting him. Don't trust people just because you like them and they're elected. Social movements are the only hope we have to get people elected who are more receptive to our program and then to keep them in a space that is not going to cave into Wall Street and the military-industrial complex power. On the contrary, we need to move them more and more in our direction. And I think it goes to the point that, although it could be heard as a cliche, it's true, when grassroots people lead, leaders can be made to follow. When you think of all the great things that have happened in recent years in terms of public policy, for instance, marriage equality, that never came from people in leadership. As a matter of fact, I think you could argue whether it's $15 an hour or free college tuition as a program, none of that came from top elected officials in Washington. It's always been grassroots organizing and activists and thinkers, and it's heard, frankly, on and through the microphones of a station such as KPFA years before it's going to be heard on NPR News on a regular basis.
Yeah. That is a kind note for you to wrap with us on. Norman Solomon, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
Norman Solomon is a media critic, the co-founder of RootsAction.org, and editor of Democratic Autopsy 1 Year Later. You can find that at democraticautopsy.org.